gentleman was finding, obviously, were quite unattractive looking things, all boxed up, didn't look much, but absolutely precious lifelines. And sometimes we read a passage like this and, you know, it may not be immediately evident how this is going to do us good. So we just trust God that he will help us as we give thought to his word. My basic message tonight is entitled Kosher Jesus. Kosher Jesus. Food. It's about food, isn't it, basically? It's about cleanliness, but in the context, essentially, of food, food preparation. Food is a massive, massive issue in our world today, in all sorts of ways. Massive issue. And it's everything from the horse meat scandal of late and the upset people felt. Not so much that it was horse meat, although that disturbed some, but the fact that choice was removed because you didn't know what you're eating. And people feel it's important to know. I want to know what I'm eating so I can choose whether I want to go French or not. And BBC recently tells us that future, that it's going to resolve the problem, the impending crisis of feeding the 7 billion people that are going to be on the face of this earth in this century. The solution to this problem is grubs and insects. Good news. Look out for the locust burger. They're coming soon to a McDonald's near you. Crunchy, yes. Well, this is serious. I mean, they're talking seriously, relatively seriously about these sort of things. Because the actual truth is, biologically speaking, you could eat anything. You are an omnivore, right? You can basically, it's incredible what human beings can eat. And if you're skillful about it, you know a bit about cooking and preparation, you can take things that are fundamentally poisonous and you can turn them around with the right processes and you can make them food for you. You can nourish yourself in the desert from a cactus. It's amazing how resilient we are in terms of what we can eat. It's incredible. And the anthropologists that go out into the jungles and find these remote tribes find them eating all manner of things, not least of which each other. And bats and tarantulas and squidgy larvae about that big. Oh yeah. So if you have qualms about traveling abroad because you're not sure about the food, France is relatively low impact. This is relatively low impact. People are eating all sorts of things all around the world. Some people love the idea of trying different things. Some people are excited by the idea. Thankfully, curry is an indigenous local British dish, and so nobody has any problem with that. But I remember not so long ago when pasta was definitely very strange foreign food. It wasn't that long ago. And some people love it. Some people love exploring. And part of the joy of travel is going to discover these different things. As you know, I'm due to go to Hong Kong at some point. My wife's been. She tells me what's in the market. I'm already having indigestion. I haven't even left. I hope nobody's listening from Hong Kong. But most people, the idea after a long holiday, even if it's been a wonderful holiday, the idea of getting back to some home cooking is usually quite an appetizing prospect, isn't it? There's no place like home. There is no place like home. And so, food. People say you are what you eat. You can tell, can't you, by the way people eat. So much about their class, their education, their attitude to themselves, their cultural experience. True? How they view themselves, and so on. You can tell the person with a tiny little thing on their plate, all carefully, you know, a little French cuisine versus the pile of chips. You can tell a lot about people by the way they eat. And people judge each other. They judge each other about their food. Whether you put ketchup on the table, whether you squirt ketchup all over your chips or put it on the side. People watch and make notes of each other, how they eat. Do they eat with their fork like this? And so on, and their manners. All these things, all surrounding food. This is loaded. Food, the subject of food, is loaded with significance and meaning. And people judge themselves about food. Naughty, in the biscuits. They regulate themselves and punish themselves and motivate themselves. If I finish this job, I will have a cup of tea. It's so crucial, isn't it, to our lifestyles. It's so important. So many of our qualms and our scruples are around food, our preferences. Because food is the fundamentals of our culture, isn't it? It's what we do every single day, morning, noon, and night. It's fundamental to our culture. And when people slip from their cultural kind of boundaries, it's usually viewed as a sign of some form of decline. When you start doing things that are unacceptable in your group, you start eating things or eating in a way that are unacceptable, seen as a sign. For example, mad cow disease. The moment we started feeding pigs to cows, the reaction was, this is a sign of moral and spiritual decline. Do you see? They were saying this is materialism gone mad. You can see that you don't serve pigs to cows. This is immoral. The reaction was that it's actually, scientifically, it's just a protein transfer. But our outrage was moral. So there are some foods that some people, I will never eat at McDonald's. I'll never let that cross my lips. And then the day comes where you actually are hungry. I don't mean just peckish. I mean you are hungry, and that's all there is to offer. And you take that over your lips, and you humble yourself, and you eat. That's a sign that I've slipped, that I've failed in some way, that I have to eat this. And people are so concerned. This is the end of my introduction, I promise. People are so concerned because food and the food chain and how we process food and what we do to the animals and how they live their lives, that it has massive moral implications and even existential implications, what it could do to the world, the extinction of species, the disruption of the food chain, the clearing of the rainforest just so that we can eat beef, so much beef. They're all loaded issues. And so you won't be surprised to find that there isn't one single religion on earth that I'm aware of that doesn't address the issue of food. Islam, you can't eat pork. I don't know if there's any other things they can't eat in Islam. Somebody can enlighten me, but I know you can't drink alcohol. In Hinduism, you can't eat any meat at all. In Buddhism, you can't eat any meat at all. All the religions, halal, vegetarianism, all these sort of things, feel it's important to rein in on diet, to deal with the issue of food in some way, because it's an existential issue. It's about our existence. Give us this day our daily bread. It's substance. It's the fundamental substance of life. So I don't suppose you'd be surprised to come across a chapter like this in the Bible that goes into extensive detail about what you're going to eat. You shouldn't be surprised, should you? Is this the first example of regulations about food in the scriptures, starting from Genesis going forward? How early? In the first chapter of Genesis, God speaks. When the first actual command we are given, Before the apple, all the fruit of the trees are for you, and all the seed-bearing plants are for you for food. Yes, indeed. But he addresses the matter of food with human beings from the beginning, doesn't he? Don't quibble, Sandy. And And you're right.
And then the collapse of it all, a bit of fruit. A bit of fruit. Somebody eating the wrong kind of food. And that has brought every single misery you see on the television, every tear you've ever shed, has come from that. So this is not a light matter. This is not a light matter at all. And in consequence of the fall, after the initial regulations of what they were to eat, which they broke, the matter had to be re-regulated. At which point? Noah, after the flood. I think for very practical means of necessity, in chapter 9 and verse 3, the menu for mankind is somewhat extended to include meat for the first time, for God's people. Because I think, quite simply, there were no trees. And there was nothing growing. And they would die. So he granted them this condescension to be able to eat other living creatures. So it is a bizarre thing. Practically every child, at some point in their upbringing, asks the question, that moment of realization, is this a lamb? And that existential question is asked. Most children. But yes, God gives them, grants them. But it's interesting, you go back into chapter 8 of Genesis, even before mankind is welcome to eat meat for the first time properly, already, as far as the altar is concerned, as far as sacrifices are concerned, God was being offered animals on the altar already. And what's very important about that, and this is what brings us to the text eventually, that they're described as clean and unclean animals. Already there was a distinction in the mind of God between what is an unclean creature and a clean creature. And that's important. Because what we're reading here in chapter 11 is the way those categories from the altar are being rolled out onto the tables of the families of the children of Israel. That definition of clean and unclean seems to go right back into Genesis chapter 1, verse 25, when the creatures, when he created all the creatures, he said, the livestock and the wild animals. There seems to be already a distinction between two different kinds of animals that he's made, even from that point. And all these creatures that are offered on the altar, are basically being offered to men to join the Lord at his table, with, I think, the exception of fish. If somebody can show me one example of fishes being offered on the altar, I'd be astonished and amazed. I'm unaware of one. And I think the simple reason is this, because we know there was a fish gate in Jerusalem, so fish was being brought into Jerusalem. But I think, as you know, when you have to bring fish dead rather than alive, that's the problem, isn't it? Whereas everything else can be brought living for sacrifice. So I think that's why fish are not included in that regard. You needed to know that. This is essential knowledge, isn't it, right? But in this passage in Leviticus chapter 11, the same definitions that you see in Genesis, the creatures of the land, the creatures of the sea, the creatures of the air, the creatures on the ground, are all there reflected in the passage. The creatures on the land, the split hoof, chewing the cud, you can eat them. And in the main, I think we all agree that broadly our own diets would revolve around that kind of description. Most of the things that we would eat, okay, we might eat the occasional rabbit, and I think pigs are, of course, the glaring pink exception. And in the sea, broadly speaking, we'd all agree that fins and scales seems a pretty good definition of the kind of thing we enjoy from the sea, broadly speaking. Jellyfish, not so sure. But when it comes down to things like shellfish, then we realize that we have a slightly different diet to what's being described here. Then in the air, it mentions a whole lot of creatures in the air, herons and kites and eagles and all sorts of things. Most of the translations are broadly lost. They're not entirely sure what most of these creatures are, and even the rabbis going back really are pretty perplexed by the whole thing. But you can see it seems to be an itemized list of relatively carnivorous creatures, and therefore probably that's the broad definition. Eat a chicken, you know, it eats grain, but an owl, maybe not. And we sort of echo with that, don't we? We can sort of, we have some sympathy with that idea. And as far as eating things on the ground goes, the weasels, the centipedes, the rats, we feel quite a lot of resonance with the text that says, leave them. No. No. So our actual, our own orientations, our cultural orientations are not massively different, with a few exceptions to the ones that we're reading about here in chapter 11. But it's very, very clear here. If you eat or touch or have any contact with any of these unclean creatures, you will become unclean. And somebody mentioned the other day, being asked to wash your clothes is not like us who can just stick them in the tumble dryer. This is an all-day affair at a point where water is exceptionally precious. This is a very costly penalty. Breaking up your oven. If I told you that if you cooked the wrong thing in your oven, I was going to come and take your agar out and smash it to pieces and you have to buy a new one, you might think twice about cooking it. Likewise, the pots, precious pots, these were highly expensive household goods. You own just a handful of these things. You have to smash these pots if they so much as touch one of these unclean creatures. So very severe boundaries are being laid down of what you can and what you cannot do. Full stop. You can't even touch their dead bodies. And at the end of the passage in chapter 47, the commission is given to Aaron and his sons that they as priests are to police and oversee and ensure that these rules are kept to the letter. And if somebody comes to you with some creature they've never seen before, they have to caught out in the bush somewhere, and it's all looked like this, can we eat this? Somebody has to make a decision. Does it fit the criteria? And if it doesn't, it's got to go. You can't have it. That's the way it is. A very, very strict diet. Now, I looked up the rabbis because I thought they ought to have something to input on this subject. And I've just got one or two little quotations for you. By observing these laws, the Jew can pull himself up the ladder of holiness. In short, you're being told categorically here, if you'll listen, that if you'll observe the laws of kosher, you can get closer to God. Fundamentally, aren't you? This is the way to get close to God. The arguments. Why is it that God has given the Jews kosher and not laid regulations on the other nations? And the answer is this, again from the rabbis. A doctor had two patients. He prescribed one of them a diet, and the other he told they could eat whatever they liked. Shortly afterwards, the one who was given whatever they liked to eat died. And the person who was given a diet survived. When asked, why did you give a diet of, you could eat what you liked to the person who died, and a diet to the one who survived, the answer came, I knew there was nothing I could do to help the one who I allowed to eat what they liked. But the one who I could see could get well, I gave a strict diet to improve their strength and stamina so that they could live. Can you see the argument that basically God has given kosher to the Jews because they have the potential for spiritual life, and the rest of the world might as well eat what they like, because point blank, they're going to hell. So can you see the argument here for kosher is it not about health, although there are lots of arguments to say this is actually God's ultimate health diet. And some books come out in America recommending kosher as God's ultimate health diet. This isn't about health. This is about spiritual progress, closeness to God. This is about your relationship to God. In short, if you will eat these things, you will gain spiritual health through your obedience to God. If you transgress these laws, you will decline in spiritual health because you, like Adam and Eve, ate the apple, you ate the thing, and because you have disobeyed the Lord whom you should fear, you will die. That's the argument. That's the argument. So they say, Why did God choose just food? Why food? And you can hear some resonance in some of Jesus' teaching here. Holiness is to begin in the ordinary things of life. And only once you've perfected those things will you have opportunity to attain the lofty things. I suppose it's a bit like to whom is faithful with a little, I'll make you Lord over much, or something like that. What's clear is that these laws drew a group of people together, formed a culture, a tight-knit group of people with shops and restaurants and supply chains and procedures and abattoirs, a whole culture that was absolutely hermetically sealed and exclusive and inclusive. You knew if you were in, you knew if you were out, who you could eat with, who you couldn't eat with. And you've got a group of people sealed in and everybody else sealed out, because the moment a person starts to eat the wrong food, they say, you're out of the family, you're out of the tribe. Unless you repent and come back. Or you see another person, you can see by the way they're eating, you just say, that person has no hope. Just from your food. Because if they haven't started to obey God in these things, what hope could there be in obeying God in the great things? And then in the book of Acts, chapter 10, and verse 14, I'm being cooked here. Everything changes. After 1,500 years of the most rigorous dietary policing, after 1,500 years, this man who is keeping kosher assiduously is on the roof of a house looking out over the sea, peckish, waiting for his dinner. And out of the sky, he sees a vision of this sheet coming down with all these creatures on it. Not just the clean creatures, but all the creatures on it. And he knows it's the voice of God, and God's saying to him, go and kill and eat. And he is absolutely horrified. I've never eaten anything disgusting like that in all of my days. Kill and eat. Three times. Kill and eat. And straight after that, this abominable vision, there's a knock on the door. An invitation to dinner at the Gentile's house. I have no idea what they're going to be serving. I'll have no control over it whatsoever. This could be quite a moment. Would you go? 1,500 years of cultural conditioning. Would you eat a caterpillar? Don't like the idea. If I dangled a snake in front of you, have a bite? You're imbued with a sense of you detest things. And then God is saying, that which I have do not call unclean, that which I have called clean. Where did God ever say suddenly that now these things were all clean? When did he say such things? How could Peter know that this was God speaking, not a pre-lunch one of those funny dreams? Mark chapter 7 verse 18, Jesus reasoning in the marketplaces. Don't you see, whatever goes into a person from the outside cannot defile him, since it enters not into his heart, just into his stomach, and is expelled. There's a euphemism at work. Thus he declared all food clean. A declaration, a sovereign declaration being made. All, this is absolutely mind-blowing. He has just taken the kosher laws and just gone, that hasn't he? Or so it seems. What comes out of a person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of man, comes evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within. That's what defiles a person. He's right, isn't he? Kosher was always about the heart, you see, not about health. Of course it had to be a healthy diet, otherwise all the Jews would have died. All diets are reasonably healthy. You can live on practically anything reasonably. But this is about the heart. It's about training these people in obedience, fostering a love for God and His Word in their lives. And you can go through the motions and do all this sort of thing and go into a sort of spiritual sleep because of the warmth of it all. And forget this is your communion with the living God. Trust and obey. There is no other way to be happy in Jesus than to trust and obey. That's what it was all about. Creating a right heart. But just eating the food can't make you spiritually healthy. What's so sad was that Peter, who had this incredible revelation, we read about it in Galatians chapter 2, verse 12, and we were talking about the misery of the situation in the Galatian church. It was all about food. It was all about food. For before certain men came from James, Peter was eating with the Gentiles, eating as he had before. But when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing the circumcision party. There was so much pressure. This was a high pressure situation. What can you eat, Christians? What can you eat? You can eat anything, can't you? You are free. Yes, you are free. But can you eat something that causes your brother to stumble? No, of course not. Because you love your brother, right? And you're sensitive to each other's needs and you care about each other. And you want the person to prosper and be well and happy. But as long as you're doing it in love and for the purpose of the gospel and its advance and its peace, you can eat whatever you like. Is there an exception? Things offered to idols, blood. Acts chapter 15, there's a mention about Christians not eating blood. But it's interesting, if you trace the history of that back, it doesn't go back to Leviticus here. We've read a lot about not eating blood in Leviticus. It goes back to Noah, to chapter 9, and in the same verse where they were allowed to eat meat, it says, but you shall not eat a creature with its blood still in it, for the life is in the blood. And I'm sorry to broach it with you exactly what that means. Essentially, it's not about drinking the blood and all that sort of thing, which is an exceptionally nourishing meal in its own right and all those sort of things. It's about actually eating a living creature, as if you've returned to being like a wild animal and you just fall on your prey and devour it. You know, stop. This is a living creature. You are made in the image of God. God made this creature. Stop, give thanks, and give proper respect to what God has made. So you can eat what you like. It's how you eat, why you eat, that's another matter. Because your relationship with God is what this is all about. It's what it's all about. So what was the diet for over all those years? It's about forming a committed community of obedient people. David kept kosher. Isaiah kept kosher. Aaron kept kosher. All of these people. Did Jesus keep kosher? To the very, very end. We looked at it at Easter, didn't we? And the cup is offered to him, which is defiled because it's richly defiled, because it's not appropriate kosher for the Passover and so on. He can't consume the cup. He's keeping this law perfectly right to the end, because this is more than just a diet. I mean, and more to righteousness than just what you eat and eating in the right spirit, because there's so many other laws and so many other commandments that laid on God's people, including these dietary laws. And it creates, all these laws create. Have you ever seen it like this? The Ten Commandments, have you ever read the Ten Commandments as a prophecy? Have you read the Ten Commandments as a prophecy?
Thou shalt love the Lord your God and have no other gods before me. Of a man, speaking about a man, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit murder. It's a description of a person. The commandments are also given by the prophets who are foreseeing the perfect Israelite, the obedient Israelite, the one who keeps the law in all its details, in all its parts, the one who fears the Lord. And they're always foreseeing and prophesying and speaking about that one all the time, even in this, what they shall eat, down to its tiny little details. Blessed is the man who trusts the Lord and keeps the commandments. That man, who is that man? Is it you? Are you that man? Are you? Are you him? Who is the man? Where is the man who loves the Lord like this? Because when he appears, as he keeps God's commandments and fears the Lord, so the Spirit of the Lord will be upon him, and it will be evident to all who this man is. And we will anoint him as our king, like David. We will ascribe him to be our prophet, like Isaiah. We will call him our priest, like Aaron. And when he is both king and priest and prophet, we will recognize that at last God has sent the Christ. He has sent the long-awaited Messiah of Israel. It was a wedding yesterday. It was a very nice wedding. Young man there, you couldn't see two different families being joined together at this wedding. It was quite extraordinary. I don't mean to be sort of overly simplistic about it, but definitely one side of the family was rather like this, and the other side of the family was more like this. But at the head of the table, those two young people were one. It was wonderful. And joy just filled the place as a result. All the differences melted into insignificance. Because in that moment, marriage is given as a sign, isn't it? It's given by God as a sign. It speaks of Christ and his church. Whatever was actually going on in their emotional... To all intents and purposes, as far as we could all see, is that group was sitting up at the head table, fellowshipping together, having a good time together. These two families had been melded together into one. We were one. And the differences didn't matter anymore. Because that young man had... somehow, and my cousin Priscilla, I hope she's not listening to this, my cousin Priscilla is one of the most fastidiously clean women in the world, right? And I don't know how, up until now, no man has ever been allowed to get this far, because they're just too dirty. But he's done it. Carl asked her, and she said yes. And we're all just rejoicing, you know? And my uncle is quite a ferocious character. He's an ex-naval commander. He's the commander, a frigate, and a nuclear submarine. And he managed to go around to his house and say, could I marry Priscilla, please? And my uncle said, yes. Somehow, he passed the test. He passed the bar. He managed to convince them. And when it came to the ceremony, they went around to the church and they scrutinized their... his background or whatever in convictions, and the priest was happy to conduct the wedding. And then at that moment, that beautiful moment, was, is there any lawful impediment? Remember that question that happens in the marriage day? Is there any lawful impediments? And there was silence in the room, because he was on the right side of Priscilla, he was on the right side of my uncle, he was on the right side of the priest, and he was on the right side of the law. This man had arisen. And he was the bridegroom. And she was the bride. And no more applications were necessary. It is over. It is finished. They are now married. And they are starting a family together. And so when Christ comes as the fulfiller of the law, he has kept the law. Is there any lawful impediment, even down to these tiny little dietary codes about the shape of an animal's foot that you've eaten? It's him. It's him. The highest bar of them all. The greatest prize of them all. The most glorious office of them all. The most glorious ministry of them all.
Christ has triumphed. He is kosher, isn't he? He is absolutely kosher. And now, after Carl managed to persuade Priscilla to marry him, the invitations were delivered. Here, there, and everywhere, to both sides of the families, completely different people, Jews and Gentiles, as different as that, to all come together to the marriage supper, to all sit down and to be united and to be one, and to have one meal and to celebrate together, because those boundaries are no longer necessary anymore. The work is finished. It's over. It's done. Honestly, it really was like the culture vultures versus the crazy gang, which is like Wigan, Man City yesterday, wasn't it? It was just two completely groups, two totally different groups. And Wigan definitely won yesterday. Wigan definitely won. It was great to see. Jesus, our blessed assurance.